Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors. Asking the questions no one else asks. Creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin, and welcome back to America Trends. Tribalism, that's on my mind today, and it has divided this country in ways that seem unalterable. Let's hope that's not the case and that a great coming together around our many serious problems is just over the unforeseen horizon. In many ways, that's what this podcast is all about. That's what we attempt. Trends that may not be visible in the moment, but are more apparent as you explore one topic in our society, in politics, or another. I believe, for example, that the issues that we really have to address and that we've let fester for so long, like our issues of racial inequality, issues of policing in America, or the debts and deficits that we are accumulating for the next generation. Or if you're looking at our healthcare system, clearly we have to make some changes there, if nothing else, to make it more affordable. What about the roads that you travel over? We've talked about them and the infrastructure in America. In many ways, I have the belief, and I may be wrong, that conservatism and liberalism is not going to be really top of mind going forward. It's more going to be the seriousness of these many issues. And while researchers say that we as humans are hardwired for tribalism and that labeling is biological, can you imagine that? Perhaps with some determination and willingness on our part to look in new ways at the issues that divide us, we can pull the plugs and the wires on tendencies that have defined the human condition for so long and now plague this society. For example, if you were determined to label me, you'd see a 68-year-old white man who has some means and lives in a Republican town in Connecticut. I have all the markings of a conservative by label and sorting. But I'm really moderate to quite liberal in my politics and would not fit whatever label you might put on me. Our guest, Irshad Manji, in her new book, and it is an incredibly well-written piece, Don't Label Me. It will get you thinking in totally new ways. But she might suggest that the loathed white guy isn't the only one putting a tag on others, but that everyone is at it, even those who are champs of diversity. I've done it, labeled fellow Americans as bigots and racist by virtue of the boxes they check, say Southern, white, and of a certain age, and that's wrong. Manji argues for honest diversity. In this moment, and in her compelling approach to the topic, she is well worth paying attention to. Some might say she's pitch perfect for the moment. Take a listen and come away with a lot to think about as to how we approach others to make this society work for all of us. That's what we're doing today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Irshad Manji. And the book that she has written is really remarkable. It's called Don't Label Me, How to Do Diversity Without Inflaming the Culture Wars. And I've got to tell you, there was an insight on virtually every page, Irshad. And I'm not just saying that to you. I mean, things that I had never really processed in the way that you are trying to get us to process what it is that we think about each other and how we relate to one another. But I've got to tell you, it really came into view for me because I thought, wow, she's being so magnanimous. And in these times, I'm not that magnanimous with people with whom I disagree. I am not feeling warm and fuzzy toward them or even accommodating at sometimes, because I do feel strongly that they are, well, misguided, or they're putting their faith in something that I can't even begin to imagine why they're doing that. But you really got my attention and made me understand your point when, of course, you talked about stereotyping. And in this country of ours, which is quite diverse, and you said, for example, about being white, male, heterosexual, and old, and I fit all of those categories, all of them. And yet, if somebody looked at me and said, by virtue of that, well, you must believe this, or you must like what the president has to say, or whatever it may be, and that is so wrong about me. So if that's the label that's being put on me just because of those attributes, they've got me all wrong.
That, you've just summarized the book, Larry. Thank you. Glad to visit with you, but have a great day. You know, when people write and talk about diversity these days, often it becomes a lecture about the racism exhibited by white people, or the misogyny and sexism exhibited by men, or the homophobia exhibited by straight people. And I think that diversity gets a really bad rap because of the way that people who advocate diversity, and I'm one of them, pursue it. You know, we tend to be stereotyping other people in our crusade against stereotyping. And that's why I knew I had to write this book, because diversity is a great idea and it's a fact of life. But if those of us who are passionate about it and see the value of it undermine it by being closed-minded ourselves, by, you know, generalizing about others, and by labeling people who we in turn are saying, hey, don't label me, then all we get is payback. And as I made clear in this book, payback is not progress.
Well, of course, when you said that when Donald Trump came down the escalator back in 2015, that in effect, he was saying to diversity lovers, well, look, if you're going to be slapping labels on white folks and folks who are older and those who feel dispossessed by America today, even though some may wonder why they do, then that gave him the moral authority to label others like Mexicans, Muslims, and others.
Yeah, and of course, I don't believe that Donald Trump has the moral authority to label anybody. I will not give him that authority. What I am pointing out, though, is that he assumed that authority. He took that authority because he saw how political correctness has run amok in America. He could feel how the people he was speaking to at that first press conference, he could feel what they were feeling, and he tapped into it. And so the irony here is that those of us who applaud diversity have done diversity no service by labeling people who are skeptics of diversity as racist, as misogynist, as homophobe. In fact, we've given Donald Trump the ammo to run with the anger and the frustration that many people, particularly in, you know, so-called middle America, feel when they are told, oh, well, you know, if you're not for gay marriage or, you know, equal marriage, as we would call it, well, then you must be anti-gay. When so many of them say, no, wait a minute, I don't think I'm anti-gay, I just worry about what all of this means to traditional marriages. And if we were willing to listen, if we were willing to ask them questions, not gotcha questions, but sincere questions, and willing to hear where people like that are coming from, then here's the great kicker. We could actually learn about their values and then reframe our own point in a way that speaks to those values.
So how easy is that to do?
Well, obviously, if it was so easy, everybody would be doing it, right? But here's the thing. You know, change, Larry, change is never easy. Never easy. And so anybody who goes into a conversation saying, how can I change that person's mind, already has made the first and biggest mistake of pursuing change. You're never going to change someone's mind by making them believe that they're wrong. In fact, think about it. If we are made to feel that we are wrong, what happens? Do we automatically say, oh, I guess you're right. Yeah, okay, good, I'm on board.
Well, you talk about humiliation, and people feeling humiliated really react so violently. It's one of those incredible emotions that stays with you.
And this is not, you know, mere surmising. Social scientists have proven that humiliation is one of those deep-seated, emotions. It claws into us deeper than anger does. It lasts longer than happiness does. It is the kind of mistake that anybody who is seeking social change, or for that matter, any kind of change, needs to understand. This is the last thing you want to do to the person from whom you're seeking change. Now, let me just say, just to finish off my previous point, that, you know, when you feel humiliated, Larry, or when I feel humiliated by somebody who disagrees with me, I'm not going to just, you know, snap my fingers and go, oh, yeah, of course, thank you for enlightening me. I mean, I might say that sarcastically, but I won't mean it sincerely. Instead, I'm going to dig my heels in further. Why? Because now I'm defensive. And in order to protect myself, you know, my ego says, don't let them see you sweat. You know, stand your ground. And so all we get is us against them. That may be good for making you feel self-righteous, but don't think that you've made a difference because you haven't.
When did all of this become so difficult, and where we really went into our own camps and they are poles apart? By that I mean America's whole experiment has been that there's not an ethnicity in America. There's an ideal that all ethnicities who come here come here often for that reason. Now, some have come here because they were subjugated and they had to earn, unfortunately, their right to, at the table. But, you know, generation after generation, more people are at the table and we are working together, or this society, this fragile thing of ours, couldn't last and couldn't grow in the way that it has. So when did this become such a cause celeb when we've been doing it, in a sense, since our founding?
Many observers have pointed out that the polarization, the us against them, that we're experiencing, by the way, not just in America, but in countries around the world, is something that Americans have gone through many times, whether, you know, leading up to the Civil War, whether during the late 1960s when actual assassinations took place in the name of, you know, in the name of supremacy, ideological, racial, and otherwise. And so what we're experiencing right now is not new as such, but what does make it new are the stakes. So, you know, we've learned just in 2020, to say nothing of 2019 and the years before, that we are facing existential crises in this world, whether it's climate change, whether it is global pandemic related to climate change, whether it is automation, artificial intelligence, mass migration, the rise of populism left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the problem. If young people today are not being educated to communicate across lines of disagreement, then they're never going to have lasting solutions to any of these high-stakes problems. Why? Because imposing an answer on the other side is not the same as solving the problem. Imposition only generates blowback. So all you get in that case is an exchange of dogmas. My dogma is better than your dogma. No, screw you. My dogma is better than your dogma. You don't actually move the needle. all that moves is the hamster wheel that goes round and round with, you know, despair deepening and cynicism rising. It's the
Well, you say labels keep us all in our assigned places, and at the root of that, that's why we're divided as we are. We have already categorized so many people, put them in their box, that we really don't need to ask ourselves more imposing and difficult questions about why they believe what they believe and why they don't believe what we believe, which is really the art of conversation today, is not to find out what you believe, but to try to convince you to believe what I believe.
And not only are you right about that, Larry, but I have to emphasize that none of this is about civility for the sake of civility. It's about recognizing the ironclad law of human psychology, which is this: if you wish to be heard, you must first be willing to hear. Can I give you a quick example of what I mean by that?
Of course, of course.
So one of the stories that's told in Don't Label Me is about two young people, both of them born in Biloxi, Mississippi, both of them raised there. One of them, the young woman, Genesis, is a hip-hop artist, African-American, and her grandfather was murdered by the KKK. The other individual is a young man named Lewis, and he is white, and he is a member of a club called the Sons of Confederate Veterans, so he's a direct descendant of a Confederate soldier. And one night, Genesis, the hip-hop artist, launches a tirade against the Mississippi state flag, which still contains slavery-era symbolism. And she does something pretty inflammatory. You know, she ties a noose around her neck, and she lights a lighter under the flag. She doesn't burn it, but she throws the flag into the audience, and she says to them, go ahead, you rip this up. Well, needless to say, lots of photos were taken. They went viral. She gets death threats. Now, in and among all of the threats and the vitriol and the violence that is thrown her way comes a post from a guy she used to know way back when they were just in elementary school, namely Lewis. And he says, look, I don't agree that you should die for this, but I so don't agree with your position on this. What does Genesis do? She could have labeled him racist, rolled her eyes, snapped her fingers, and just, you know, continued to scroll through her posts. But instead, and remember, she hasn't seen him for decades, she invites him to her backyard. And she asks him to tell her how he feels about that flag. That's literally her first question. How does the flag make you feel, Lewis? It's not an intellectual question. It's not a gotcha question. It's a very basic human question. He answers. He replies, it makes me feel like I'm home. And because she has asked him that question, he reciprocates. How does it make you feel? And she explains exactly, you know, where she's coming from. And over the course of that conversation, Lewis realizes something. That even though he still wants the flag to stay as it is, he winds up caring more about Genesis than he does about the flag itself. And why does he wind up caring more about her? I asked him that after they spoke. And he said, it's because I have never been shown so much respect by somebody who is my opponent. And I said, respect, huh? And notice that that didn't mean I have to agree with you or you have to agree with me. That's not respect. Respect comes from the Latin word respectate, which means look again. Genesis didn't reduce him to a label. She looked again. And because she thought that he's so much more than the baggage that goes with a label I would attach to him, I've got to engage him. I've got to speak with him. I've got to find out why he believes what he believes. And when she did, Lewis, over time, became one of her biggest supporters. As I was putting this book to bed, Larry, I called Lewis up just to triple check one particular fact in this story, and he told me something that I included at the back of the book. I would not have known this otherwise. he said that he recently took down the Confederate flag in his backyard. He folded it up neatly and respectfully, and he put it into a box called Things of the Past.
Hmm. Wow.
Notice
that is incredible.
He did not lose his heritage. He didn't lose his heritage. He decided that this can be a place that respects my friend, Genesis, as much as it respects me, and I don't stop being who I am because of it.
You've given us some new terms to put in our lexicon about topics like this. Is that an idea that really would define clearly for my listeners, honest diversity?
Glad you mentioned that phrase. Yes, in many ways it would. And let me explain what I mean by honest diversity, because in calling it that, I'm also implying that there's such a thing as dishonest diversity. But let me start there with dishonest diversity. Dishonest diversity slices and dices individuals into categories, and it leaves them there. And the problem with leaving people in categories is that these categories or labels always flatten each of us to only one dimension, when in reality, just like Lewis, we are so much more than meets the eye, so much more than any one label can capture. That's dishonest diversity, okay? When we, you know, fixate on black, white, Muslim, Christian, socialist, capitalist. Honest diversity includes different viewpoints, not just color and religion and gender. And honest diversity, therefore, treats even people who belong to certain groups as the individuals that they are. Honest diversity recognizes that even within your group, you might be thinking differently than other people who look like you, just as I hope you know, I don't think the same as everybody who looks like me. Which is why engage one another.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Yeah, and you have engaged on issues related to your own faith and a whole range of things over your professional life. Irshad Manji is with us, a remarkable woman and an incredible book that she has labored over, as you can tell. It's called Don't Label Me, How to Do Diversity Without Inflaming the Culture Wars. You also, because I want to give people these sayings and aphorisms that they can glom onto, at least as a start, and then use that as entree into your book. You point to Bruce Lee and his harmonious individuality, and what should dominate harmony or individuality in all of this? In other words, we all want to be a part of something, but we also want our own human characteristics to be recognized for their unique quality or their unique capability, whatever it may be. And you say that in that context of learning that about Bruce Lee and not thinking of him only as a martial arts person, that he performed and also practiced his faith and the serenity surrounding it, that we must be more like water. Explain that.
Oh, my gosh. Let me tell you. It never fails to put a smile on my face when I remember the moment that I stopped labeling or reducing Bruce Lee to only martial arts master. It turns out, Larry, that he was also an incredible philosopher. And he's the one who taught his own martial arts students simple philosophy that could be, you know, summed up in just a few words. Be like water. Be fluid. Don't be rigid. Don't be closed-minded. And recognize that when you are open-minded about other people, you're going to be surprised and equally you're going to surprise them. So the point being that if you actually want to win, you know, in a movement, a cause, an argument, the best thing you can do is to be like water. Enter into the conversation, treating the other person as your teacher. Not that they need to learn from you, but that you need to learn from them. And when you ask them a question like this, tell me, can you help me understand what I'm missing about your perspective? Automatically, you are saying to them, I care enough about you that I actually want to learn from you. And I know I don't have all the answers. So over to you. Let me hear from you. That is being like water. And as long as it is not merely strategic, as long as it's sincere, you know, keep being like water. Keep asking questions based on what they just said. And you will find that the emotional defenses that they walked into the conversation with will come down. And when those emotional defenses come down, they will literally have more brain space to now hear where you're coming from. This is how Bruce Lee taught martial arts. Well, I guess you could say that this is how I teach moral arts.
You know, when I go back to the 2020 campaign and I think about somebody like Pete Buttigieg and some of the issues that he had to overcome, I mean, being the first openly gay married man running for president, and yet that never, to me, dominated his campaign. And you said in the book that political correctness may be getting in the way of solving real and vexing issues that many of us on all sides can agree are problems in America. And he often talked about that this is a moment where there is more consensus on a range of things that we may not be dealing with, like climate change, even like legal immigration and the like. But he saw ahead a horizon where we were going to come together about those issues. It would never be easy. We are still divided, but that his first job, if he ever got to the point of the nomination, was to heal this country, not to continue playing on the divisions.
Right. And some would have argued, as they did argue, that's utterly naive, because after all, isn't that what Barack Obama came into this presidency with? You know, an attitude of reconciliation, an attitude of moving beyond us against them. And many of Buttigieg's critics, like many of Obama's critics, said, you're underestimating your opponent, meaning the Republicans. They're not interested in unity. They're interested only in uniformity, meaning, you know, everybody be like them, otherwise you're the enemy. But I have to say, and I find that argument, by the way, somewhat valid. I think it's a good point. Because Obama tried, but we are now in a time where a lot of us are utterly exhausted by the verbal bomb throwing. And I have to say that everywhere I go, whether I speak to people who are part of minority communities or whether they are part of what might still be termed the mainstream, I hear from people who say, how come we don't hear these messages more? And one of the reasons we don't hear these messages more, Larry, is because of the choices that we as citizens and as consumers make about the media that we consume. Look, again, let's not be pointing fingers at everybody else out there, at the politicians and, you know, celebrities who overstep their bounds at, you know, at award ceremonies and politicized issues, et cetera. No. Let's look at, you know, what we are doing on social media, and let's look at the media that we are consuming, whether we ourselves are going beyond the headlines and actively searching out contrary points of view so that we can piece together what the truth might look like on any issue that we're passionate about. Notice I didn't say on everything. No one has that kind of time. No one has that kind of energy. But if there's a particular issue that you are utterly passionate about, then it behooves you to learn about what the, quote, truth of it actually is. And you're not going to get that from just one side or the other.
Those who are proponents of a lot of things, who are so passionate, the women who were on the street right after Donald Trump was elected, mm-hmm. The Me Too movement overall, Black Lives Matter, and they say, look, you know, trying to engage is pointless because, well, let me give you an example. In March, when we were in the midst of the coronavirus issue, and mm-hmm. of course so dominant in all of our thinking, a man who evidently is the preacher for the cabinet. I didn't even know there was a Bible teacher for the cabinet that Donald Trump has. And he basically said that the coronavirus was brought on as a result of God's wrath. And he pointed mm-hmm. to God being angry at gays, China right. itself, and environmentalists. So, I mean, I'm just going to test your thesis here. I mean, what do you say? I mean, people on the side of saying, I believe in science, I believe in logic, I believe in medicine, are going to look at that and say, where do I begin?
First of all, you don't have to begin with the preacher himself. This preacher has a public platform, obviously has a vested interest in believing what he believes. He's got a brand. He makes money from that brand and gets fame from that brand. So don't think for a minute that you have to change his mind. He's not your problem. Let him be God's problem, not yours. Second, for those who believe what he has to say, maybe it's a neighbor, maybe it's a relative, that's the person whom you should be engaging because that preacher has no power if he has no following. And at that point, you've got to remember, if you go into the conversation with that preacher's supporter asking yourself, how do I change this supporter's mind, you're going to wind up treating that supporter as an object to manipulate. And just as you don't like being toyed with, just like you don't like being played, neither will the other person. So the real test of your willingness to make the kind of social change that sticks is your willingness to listen to where that person is coming from. Don't assume that they're simply crazy or evil. That's labeling them.
Mm-hmm.
Ask them, you know, tell me about the experiences you've had that lead you to believe that this guy is right. And depending on what they say, then ask them more questions. And again, I have to emphasize, Larry, questions not with the intention to win a debate, because this doesn't need to be a debate. Questions with the intention to understand. And again, that doesn't mean you agree with them. It means that you are giving them the fair hearing that they will now be morally obligated to give to you. And listen, you might walk away from that conversation saying, well, that was a waste of time. But was it? It was only a waste of time if you took nothing from the conversation that helps you reframe your points later on in a way that speaks to that person's values. Then it becomes a waste of time, and that's not their fault.
You know, you are really so amazing in the way that you can describe your thoughts about this entire process. And I'm just wondering a couple of things. Number one, I just filled out the 2020 census. And, of course, as part of the census, so that various goods and services from the government can be allotted, they are asking us to label ourselves.
Yeah.
The point, because the book is called Don't Label Me, well, mm-hmm. labeling has a purpose. And in this case, having just filled this out, it just came to me in the context of your book.
No, it's a great question. And can I confide to you that when I fill out the census, which I received in the mail also, I'm probably going to be cheeky and say, don't label me. I kid you not. Now, they'll do what they want to with that, but I filled out the census. I'm not saying that I won't complete it. I'll do my civic duty to do that. I just won't answer it in the conformist way that they expect me to. All right. So, but are there times when labels matter and are useful in a positive way? Sure. And I understand why, for the purposes of a census, we need to know, you know, who's in the country, what services they may need, how demographically, you know, the change is being distributed throughout the country, et cetera, et cetera. So what I say in the book is, look, even on an individual level, our brains work overtime to label things. A door is a door. A window is a window. A table is a table. I'm labeling these things because I need to make sense of the world around me, okay? So, yeah, labels are fine as long as they are starting points. But starting points to what? Starting points to further discovery. What is it, you might ask yourself, that I don't know about this person, this human being, this non-static thing? That what is it that I don't know about them and that this label would never tell me about them? If you really care about getting to know somebody, and that's if, then you've got to engage. You can start with a label. Just don't make it your finish line, because the amount that you're going to learn about how the world works when you talk to people who are very different from you will floor you and will actually make you a smarter, more interesting person in your own right.
You know, it's interesting. I've been writing songs lately, and I was moved by the film Escape from Dannemora on Showtime about those two convicts in upstate New York who escaped and the woman who helped them, Tilly. And I wrote a song called Ain't We All Tilly, Building Prisons in Our Mind. And, you know, the issue there is that we can categorize and label by so many different means. I mean, whether it's age, whether it's color, whether it's size, whatever it may be. And I'm just wondering, because the workplace is often talked about in the context of diversity, and many workshops take place, and many people want to help with that issue in their workplace. And I was interviewing someone who told me that Shimon Peres, who was the former prime minister of Israel, said probably one of the greatest divides in this era of diversity, as we think of ourselves and put ourselves in our own prisons in our mind, is age. That, in fact, there's more about the age differential in this issue of diversity than almost any other. What are you finding in the workplace as it relates to this issue of diversity?
Boy, there's so much I could say about age and, frankly, about the prejudice against people who are older. You know, so much around diversity and inclusion that is happening in corporate America today. And let me tell you, it is the hottest issue in corporate America today. So much of it revolves around younger people and how, you know, people who are just graduating from university or have just graduated or who are, you know, out of university for 4 or 5 years and are now integrating into the workforce, what their demands are and around, you know, being treated with what they would say is dignity. And so, for example, a lot of executives call me or email me these days after having read Don't Label Me to say, Irshad, you won't be surprised to hear, I'm dealing with conflict in my company, but, you know, based around people's identity. And some people are offended by something that somebody else says. It was, you know, an innocent question, or at least the person who said it thought it was innocent. But instead of actually talking it out, you know, our newer hires take it directly to HR and insist on compliance. And then it becomes punitive, and that demoralizes other employees. And it, you know, creates friction where surely there's a better way of approaching all of this. Yes, there is a much better way. And the better way, if I can put it succinctly, is this. I would suggest that anybody who is an employer today do not strive merely for diversity of demographics in your company, meaning different groups of people. The moment you start with labels and categories, you exclude people, because not everybody fits those labels and categories. So you're creating walls where none needed to exist. Instead, make a sincere and serious commitment to this goal, diversity of viewpoint. That creates bridges. Why? Because it invites people in, including straight white guys. Diversity of viewpoint replaces labels with dialogues. And the beauty is, if you are seriously and sincerely committed to diversity of viewpoints, then the demographics will naturally follow. After all, somebody who has experienced racism or some other form of prejudice will naturally see much of the world in a different way than somebody who has not experienced that prejudice. So absolutely go for diversity of viewpoints. Be committed to it. And that way you'll get the diversity of people without immediately causing friction, because now you're prioritizing some categories and some labels over others.
Irshad, you've given me a lot of your valuable time. Just a couple of more questions. You say in the book, and I thought this was really important, that change doesn't freak out traditional Americans. It's the pace of change. Is that really what is the lubricant in a lot of this?
It's certainly what the renowned sociologist Robert Putnam from Harvard University has found. For those who don't know, Putnam is a liberal-leaning sociologist, made his name with a book called Bowling Alone about decline, right, of civic activity in America. This was like many, many years ago. And he has continued to do really pioneering work. And a recent report that he came out with challenged his own convictions, Larry. He actually went on record to say, this makes me very uncomfortable to put out, because I know I'm going to be labeled a racist for putting out this information, but it's where my research took me. And he pointed out that it is not so much that ordinary Americans don't want diversity. It's that too much demographic change too fast makes people go into their shells. And it contributes to segregation of people. And that's not because the people who go into their shells are bad or evil or prejudiced. It's because of the way our own brains work as human beings. Most people don't realize that our brains are very, very primal organs, and they still operate in the first instance as if we are hunter-gatherers on the savanna, as if there's a threat lurking behind every noise that we hear. And the moment we feel threatened, the brain, which is where the ego resides, says fight or flee. And many people flee. Many people hide. They go into their turtle shell. We have to understand that this is how biology works. And we have to pursue diversity in a way that respects how biology works. And that means encouraging, for example, immigrants not to cluster into their own groups, even though it's, you know, it's the most convenient thing to do, because you naturally want to be, socializing with people who understand your culture, who understand your language right away, and so forth. But we've got to encourage ways for people to actually interact with one another and to get to know one another and to become human to one another. And that doesn't just mean the white guy toward the brown person. It also means have the brown person come to a church service on a Sunday and engage with the, you know, white and hopefully in this case also black folks, right? And get to know their community as much as you expect them to get to know your culture. So it's really got to take an effort on everybody's part to move beyond our own labels for one another, as well as the labels that we take for ourselves, and recognize that this is that disagreement, even when we disagree on something, disagreement can be an invitation to further engagement. That is how we find common ground, even as any one of us stands our ground. And that's the sweet spot that the framers wanted for this republic all along.
However, we are going to be tested once again, and maybe this lies deep within a lot of what's going on in America today, that to black, brown, multiracial babies outnumber white babies today. We know that we are going to have a different blend of people as of 2040, 2050, whatever that date might be. And never have whites been one of, they've always been dominant in the culture. I mean, so how much of what you're calling for is going to be required to get us through this transition?
All I'm calling for is for people to practice what they preach, Larry. If you're preaching, for example, that the supremacy complex was absolutely the wrong way to start this country, then don't practice one of your own. I don't mean black supremacy against white supremacy. I mean, don't practice an ideological supremacy either. You know, it's one thing to say, well, you know, the colonizers were in the wrong. They created these hierarchies where, you know, some people are at the top and the rest of us are at the bottom. That's right. That is wrong. That is not a democracy. But in pursuing the fix, then, don't flip the hierarchy and say that people like you are morally superior to everybody else, because then all you're doing is recreating the hierarchy. And that doesn't solve the problem. So at the end of the day, Larry, it's not going to be structures and institutions that change on their own. These things change when we human beings change ourselves. That's why it's got to start with introspection and with practicing what we preach, otherwise known as integrity.
You've got to get this book. And I've got to ask Irshad one final question on the way out the door today. And I'm just really curious, because you go out and you speak, and you're not afraid to speak anywhere to any group. But where do you get the most pushback, if you do, for your ideas about coming together, accommodating, understanding, reflecting? Where do you get pushback, and does it come more from those who are followers of, you know, various approaches to diversity, or is it people who are said to, by labeling, not in favor of certain changes in the society? Where do you get the most pushback?
Oh, naturally, I get the most pushback from militants, you know, from people who believe that their way is the only way, and that everybody else is ignorant and insidious. They are invested in grouping themselves and each other off and deciding that, you know, they ought to be dominant. I get pushback from people who aren't interested in solutions, but who are interested in fueling the fight, because that is where their identity lies. But I will tell you, Larry, that right across the political spectrum, really, from left to right to in between, everyday citizens, everyday people who are tired of the noise and who want to get things done and who believe that we are capable of so much more than we give ourselves credit for, what I get from them is, thank God, and what can I do in my life to, you know, continue with the moral courage that you're asking of me? And that's what I teach. I teach moral courage, doing the right thing in the face of your fear. Social science tells us that the thing that most people fear more than anything else is being judged, which is why we will always go with the flow and not point out the hypocrisy in our own tribes, even as we demand, you know, different kind of behavior from other tribes. But we've got to start within. We've got to start with ourselves and recognize that when we role model moral courage for others, that is when they see that it's possible, and that is when we give them the incentive to meet us halfway. So again, it starts with you, and it starts with me.
And by the way, you're going to meet Lily in this book. I'm not going to even talk about Lily, because you have got to read this book. Honest to goodness, and I loved Lily, and I'm sorry for your loss. This book tells us that in the United States, discord has hit emergency level. Civility isn't the reason to repair our caustic chasms. Diversity is. I thank you so much. It's been an honor to chat with you today. Irshad Manji, Don't Label Me, How to Do Diversity Without Inflaming the Culture Wars. Thank you so much for being part of America Trends.
It's a pleasure. Be well.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofit.